This is Mental, the podcast to destigmatize mental health. I'm Bobby Temps, and each week with an inspiring guest, we delve into a factor or condition that influences the mind and how to better manage it. So, here we go. This week, we're talking all about personality disorders and the associated stigmas that can so often come along with them, with a wonderful campaigner, teacher, writer called Katya Pavlovna. In this conversation, we get into a lot, and I really enjoyed it for that reason. I learned so much from Katya. And like with a lot of the guests I speak to, it's really clear that this is, you know, a passion, something she's just meant to be doing. There's a passion and a distilled determination that you get off her when I was having this conversation that's really lovely to see. She's so articulate. I said to her off air, what a wonderful teacher I think she must be. And, you know, that is contrasted with some of the stigma that she's described in terms of her own experience talking publicly about personality disorders. And, you know, it can be disheartening, but this is why we do the work that we do. That to me, this is someone that is inspirational, has a lot of life experience, and is a great role model for young people. I look forward to continuing to see a world where that is more instantly acknowledged versus other kind of assumptions that we get into in the episode. Also, it might be worth noting that we talk about psychosis in this conversation, and we recently did an episode all about it. And so if you want further background, they really kind of did go nicely sort of hand in hand in terms of the themes and the misconceptions that we tackle in both. So yeah, something to maybe visit if you haven't caught that episode a few weeks ago. For now though, we'll get into this wonderful conversation in a moment. But first, who's our sponsor? Let's find out.
My name is Katya Pavlovna. Up until recently, I had a diagnosis of borderline personality disorder that has changed in the last 2 weeks, but I think we'll probably go into that a little bit later on. In terms of my mental health, it was not really a conversation when I was growing up. I was at school in the early 2000s, and it just wasn't something that was really on the radar in terms of education. Also, when I was at school, I was quite a high achiever. And back then, it was always associated with poor academic performance if you had poor mental health. Also, it doesn't really help that around about the time that you're a teenager, you've got all of these hormones flying around, you know, you're really moody. And with something like BPD, it is often masked with that. And that's the reason why you're not diagnosed until you're at least 18. For me, when I was 14 onwards, that's really when I started to notice the onset of the BPD symptoms, although I didn't obviously know what they were at the time. So for me, the main thing was, you know, the massive mood swings that BPD is known for. So I would be completely fine 1 minute and then just switch at a moment's notice. And I would be up and down sort of throughout the day. Part of the reason why it wasn't really picked up on is the fact that when people think about BPD, they kind of think about like these explosive emotions, like the anger. But for me, it was never really like that. Like I was going through all of this emotional turmoil, but you didn't really know about it. It was very much kept inside. Also, there was a lot of problems with things like anger, but it wouldn't come out as that explosion. For me, it came out as like rudeness and passive aggression. And when you're, you know, 14 years old, it's not really that unusual to be rude and passive aggressive. But there were also other things going on at the time, problems with relationships. There was self-harm, suicidal ideation, and also a problem that has kind of persisted over time is the impulsive behaviours. So for me, I find it very difficult to regulate my emotions and my behaviour. But in terms of mental health, it was actually, I wouldn't say open in my family, but it was talked about because I do have schizophrenia on the paternal side. So it wasn't like we weren't exposed to knowledge around mental health like as I was growing up. But the main problem is getting the people around me to accept it because I didn't present as somebody that had a problem.
Was that something that was accepted for other people? So was it acknowledged that schizophrenia ran in the family?
although we knew about it and we talked about it and how the way that we treat people with mental illness in society isn't right, it wasn't really applied to me because, again, I was doing really well at school. I had friends. I would talk to people at school, friends, family, but I don't think really they realised the gravity of the problems that I was facing. And I think, to be fair, that's probably because I didn't either. And you do find, especially back in those days, people were quite dismissive of mental health problems. So if you were having issues in school, it was brushed off. It was kind of like something that everyone goes through because nobody really talked about mental health in as much depth as they do or with as much understanding as they do now back in those early days.
For sure. And this is a really interesting part of the stigma for me, where it gets so caught up with these stereotypes in a way that often you don't notice unless you're kind of on the receiving end, unless you've been there yourself, that so often you have to have an outwardly, you know, negative impact on other people for other people to take it seriously, which is so ironic given it's mental health. It's about what's happening internally, irrespective of the extent to which that's visually appearing.
Yeah, 100%. And I think for me, my main problems with mental health actually began when I was at university. And a big part of that was because I moved away. I moved to a city because I did this really niche course that was offered in like two universities. So I had to move away.
May I ask what the course was?
Yeah, it was journalism and Germanic studies. So not just German, it was like two German languages. So I did Dutch as well. Mm-hmm. I didn't end up going into journalism, obviously. So I don't know whether or not it was worth it in the end. But I did move away from home. And although that was a really good experience for me in terms of being independent, the flip side of that was that it did have a massive impact on my mental health because I was already having problems with emotional regulation, impulsive behaviour, including things like binge drinking. And when you go to university and you haven't got that support network and you are carrying on with those behaviours, you haven't got anyone who's got your best interests at heart that kind of says, actually, the behaviours that you're indulging in are not healthy. They're not good for you, because university culture in a lot of ways encourages those kind of impulsive and damaging behaviours. And for me, I found it quite difficult to make genuine friendships. So a lot of those friendships that I had when I was at university, it was about going out and having a good time in drinking and those kind of things. And that definitely didn't help. And it got a lot worse when I did my year abroad in Germany because I had absolutely nobody. I didn't go to one of the big cities and I didn't study at university. I had a work placement that was quite out in the sticks, really. So I had absolutely no support network, and that was really difficult for me. And that led to a lot of problems with depression, I guess. And that's really when I started to notice like the psychotic symptoms setting in as well, although I didn't realize that that's what they were at the time. So university, I think, was definitely a bit of a trigger for me in terms of my symptoms getting worse, and definitely the point when I noticed that I was developing BPD, although obviously I didn't know what that's what BPD was at the time, but it felt like life was getting a lot less manageable around about that time.
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, there is something I think commonly very tethering about these interpersonal connections, about having a support network beyond the kind of the obvious support, but even just hearing about other people's day-to-day experiences, I think can help keep us in reality at times when our own brain is very noisy and our kind of feeling of normality is affected. And I know for a lot of people with their experience of BPD, building up personal connections and maintaining them can be a challenge. Was that something that you were finding as well, that then when you tried to create a network, you were also finding, okay, this is more difficult than normal because of how my mental health is?
Yeah, definitely. And I think as well, with my new diagnosis that I had 2 weeks ago, you could definitely see emergent symptoms of that, in that I had quite odd behaviour. And I think when you have these odd behaviours, you either attract people because they quite like that you're weird and quirky, or you repel people. And because with BPD, you have quite a big fear of abandonment, it just makes life really difficult when you try and have sincere friendships. So a lot of the friendships that I did have were superficial, and a lot of the relationships that I was involved in romantically fizzled out quite quickly because I just really struggled to understand other people, and I didn't know why. Like, a lot of people think when you're in a relationship with somebody with BPD, it's fireworks, it's drama, and that's not necessarily the case. Like, for me, I was upset a lot of the time because I couldn't understand other people's actions and they couldn't understand mine. So it was not always the case that the relationship was terrible. There are a lot of good times as well, but also it's this main problem with just not understanding each other. And the BPD was quite a major root cause of that.
Yeah, for sure. Because so often that frustration comes out of feeling isolated and misunderstood from other people. And I think that can be missed, where it's like, oh, you're acting out, you need to be taking your meds, versus there's still a thought process that other people can support you with beyond you need to get professional help externally. There's always ways in which your friends and family can still support you as well.
Definitely. And I think when I was living in Germany as well, that was a main part of the problem, because I didn't understand how the healthcare system worked. Like, we're quite lucky in the UK that we've got the NHS. So you know that if you've got a physical or a mental health problem, you go and see your GP, and that then sets you off on the path to treatment or diagnosis or whatever it may be. In Germany, I had no clue how it worked. So I didn't see anybody for the whole time that I was living there about my mental health, because I didn't know how to access that help, and I didn't know what to ask for or what to say, because at the time I didn't have the terminology or the language to describe how I was feeling either. Because when you are going through this, unless you know other people that are struggling with their mental health, you actually don't know whether or not what you're experiencing is normal. And when you're young, you know, you talk about going out, having maybe a bit too much to drink, or dramatic relationships, struggling with emotions. That's actually quite common for a lot of people. But the way that I experienced it was to such an extreme that it was really damaging me as a person and making life very difficult for me in a way that it wasn't for other people.
Mm-hmm. And tell me if you relate to this. I find that for me, getting diagnoses has been very helpful in understanding that kind of idea of normality, that if I can see, okay, there is something here that needs to be explored and I need some support with, but within that, there is a name, there is a set of symptoms, I'm not on my own. And actually realizing that my experience of mental ill health have been kind of very common within that framework, to realize like, oh, I actually present quite typically, has been very reassuring at times when I felt very isolated and low and, yeah, othered, you know, partly because of stigma.
Yeah, I agree with that. And I think as well, especially with BPD, it gives me the language to be able to describe to other people what I'm experiencing. And it kind of ties it up quite nicely for them to understand my symptoms as a whole, because there is a name for it. I know that a lot of people are not fans of labels, and that's completely fine. But for me, especially in a working environment, if I need to communicate to people what is not necessarily wrong with me, but what I'm struggling with, then having that label can really help with that sometimes. The flip side of that is sometimes, especially with my new diagnosis, that can create the opposite of that and just create complete confusion. Like, what is it? But you know that if you've got a name for what you're experiencing, then people can go away, they can research it, and they've got a better understanding of how it affects you as a person.
Mm-hmm. And so by contrast then, so you had this diagnosis of BPD. I know it wasn't an easy diagnosis to get, which in itself, very common. This more recent diagnosis, could you tell me about that?
Yeah, sure. So actually, it's come quite quickly after the BPD diagnosis, because it took me 6 years on the NHS to get a BPD diagnosis, purely for the fact that because I don't present as people would maybe expect somebody with BPD to present, because I only meet 5 of the 9 criteria, which is the minimum, and my symptoms don't really present in a typical way. That took quite a long time. So that was in 2021, which was actually only last year. But even after I had my BPD diagnosis, I was struggling with psychotic symptoms, which is something that I had difficulty with for quite some time. Not really so much visual hallucinations, because I think that's what people think about quite a lot when you talk about psychosis, but definitely auditory and taste and smell hallucinations, and delusions is also quite a big one for me. And when we were exploring possibilities of diagnosis, I did find that people tended to focus more on like the mood and the emotional symptoms and didn't really talk a great deal with me about the psychotic symptoms. And I think for them, it was quite a black and white distinction. It must be BPD and something else, or it's psychotic symptoms within the BPD, which I accepted because obviously they're the experts. But it became obvious over time that these psychotic symptoms were just not really manageable day to day, especially being a teacher and suffering from auditory hallucinations. It's really difficult to focus on the classroom and what's going on around you if you're hearing like noises and whispering and things like that. It's really difficult. So I did pursue an alternative diagnosis because I just felt like it wasn't right for me, or at least it was BPD and something else. Mm-hmm. And that
Would you mind if we just pause on that, actually, in terms of the audio hallucinations? I'm glad that you've brought that up, as, you know, that is indeed far more common as part of psychosis than visual hallucinations. And yet it can still be difficult for people to kind of imagine what that means. And so you described like hearing whispering. To what extent were you able to separate, is that in the classroom or, you know, is that one of the kids or no?
I think it's quite contextual. So, for example, if I'm outside, it's a lot easier for me to differentiate between what's real and what's not. One thing that works quite well is actually if I'm having a lot of auditory hallucinations, I take my dogs out with me, because if they're not reacting to sounds, I know that it's highly likely that actually it must be me imagining it. In the classroom, it's a lot more difficult because I tend to hear things like tapping and whispering. I always describe it as when you are driving a car and hearing the radio on in the car behind. So when you are expecting your class to be quiet, you're never really too sure if it's actually the kids whispering or whether or not you're imagining it. But the plus side of that is that you do develop this ability to scan the room at all times, so not much gets past you, which is an amazing quality to have as a teacher. However, it can be, you know, really disruptive. And along with the delusions as well, it just makes life really difficult. And I did have antipsychotics for that, which made things a lot better. But then unfortunately, earlier this year, I had a review because I felt like my medication wasn't working as well as it could be. And the psychiatrist that I spoke to took the decision to take me off all my medication because they felt that psychosis was caused by having a vegan diet. I didn't really know what to say to that. So I just thought, you know what, I'm going to, you know, just have a bit of dairy, see if it stops the psychosis. Being quite skeptical, it didn't have any impact, surprisingly enough.
And how long have you been a vegan for? Would that have even made sense timeline wise?
No. So it was 2 years. However, I haven't always been the best at being vegan. So there have been times where I sort of have fallen off the wagon for like a day or two. But because the psychosis was really difficult for me to manage, I thought, you know, I'm just going to give it a go. I'm going to try a bit of dairy just to see what happens. And it didn't have any impact whatsoever. But then it took me 10 months to get back into the system and to get back on medication and to see a psychiatrist. So it was sort of 10 months of no treatment whatsoever, which is really difficult to manage.
That's so wild. And fair play for you keeping an open mind, because I think I would have laughed in their face.
I think I did like Google it, and it can happen in certain circumstances, but it's quite rare. And when I've got a family history of schizophrenia, that's maybe not the conclusion that I would have come to first, shall we just say. But yeah, it did take a really long time to get back into the system, and it's been really difficult with waiting lists to access help. I've been quite lucky in the meantime, because although I've not had medication, my school have worked with me amazingly well. There's things that they've put in place to make life a little bit easier for me, but it's definitely very difficult to cope with on your own. And it makes me think that people that suffer with really bad psychosis, like how they must be able to cope in those kind of situations.
Yeah, absolutely. And there is that very real fear of things potentially needing to get worse for them in order for them to get the speedy help. And then the speedy help ends up being really strong medication that can make things much worse. You know, maybe that's what they need in the short term, but it's going to take a lot longer to sort of balance out for you than having earlier intervention and milder medication. And would you mind sharing a little bit of what the school have put in place that you mentioned there?
Yeah, so school have actually been amazing. They've always been aware of my mental health. They actually actively encouraged me to talk about mental health and to educate the rest of the staff. It's not something that I always share with the students because I don't think that's fair to put them in that position. However, I do deliver training on mental health. It's a very open culture talking about mental health there. In terms of reasonable adjustments for me, I have time off for appointments when I need it. So you don't have to battle with admin, trying to get time off work. It's just accepted that that's completely fine if I need that time off. Also, because of the psychosis, it can make me extremely tired. So if I need to leave work at, say, 4:30 rather than 5:30, that's completely fine if I need to go and rest. Also, things like the free periods that I have, they're not all weighted towards one end of the week. It's divided up so that I've got breaks during the week, so it's not too much for me with a heavy teaching timetable. So that has been incredibly useful for me because psychosis isn't easy to deal with. I think if it was visual hallucinations, it might be a little bit of a different story because I can't imagine being able to teach through that. But as it is at the moment with the audio hallucinations, they don't stop me from being able to teach, but it is quite a big inconvenience.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm so glad to hear that they've made those adjustments for you. And you may not know this, but I also work in improving mental health education and campaigning for it. So that's something that I hear from a lot of teachers, that encouraging mental health to be on the curriculum and to be better taught to the students also then means there's more understanding for the teachers because they're having to learn about this stuff as part of their work, and therefore they can apply that in their, you know, their interactions with colleagues as well as the students.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. I think there is definitely scope to do more with mental health education. Like, you hear a lot about anxiety and depression and things like that, but you probably are not going to be taught so much about personality disorders and things like that in a school context. And I think for me personally, from what I've experienced, I have a little lanyard with and end the personality disorder stigma badge on it. And although I'm not open about my diagnosis and I never discuss it with my students, quite a few of them have noticed it and said, actually, we've got people in our family with personality disorders and we've got nobody to talk to about it. And they've shared their experiences with me, which has been quite enlightening. But also as well, you would be surprised how many members of staff actually have mental health problems. I was not the only teacher in my school.
Oh, I don't think I was. Yeah,
I was, you know, not the only person with borderline personality disorder in my school. And, you know, I just think we could potentially go a little bit further with educating people. I have a lot of young people who have seen TikTok on things like DID, for example, and they're like, I think I've got DID. And you're like, well, you know, maybe see a professional, and, you know, they won't generally diagnose someone who's under the age of 18. But because they are seeing this content, it's quite difficult sometimes for them to filter out what is sort of genuine shared experience and what may be slightly over-exaggerated. And you kind of see it the other way around as well when they've seen things about things like narcissistic personality disorder, and then they come out with things about narcs. And, you know, it's quite difficult. I just think if then maybe it might stop some of these misconceptions as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, the work definitely continues. And you're so right about, you know, the TikTok experience, because I see that all the time, that, you know, there's a big difference between pop psychology versus medical advice. And really, medical advice isn't something you can give, obviously, in that broad kind of way where you don't know the person that's seeing the content anyway. And sadly, the people that are more on the pop psychology end tend to be the ones that are making the catchiest videos. They're the ones that are getting shared.
I mean, I definitely don't have anything against self-diagnosis. I actually think it can be quite useful in the right context, but it needs to be educated self-diagnosis. And I think if you're not sure where this information is coming from and what the sources are, it can be quite a dangerous road to go down. So I would always say, you know, see a professional, because there are things like comorbidities that people don't consider and things like that as well. So although videos on TikTok, they do have their place, it's more about, are people getting the right information for their mental health?
Mm-hmm. And you were going to tell me about the new diagnosis.
Yeah, so this is very recent. It was only 2 weeks ago, so it's very new to me, and I still have quite a lot of research that I need to do. I have a new diagnosis of schizotypal personality disorder. It kind of goes back to what I was saying earlier about the fact that, you know, the mood and the emotional side of things was explored quite deeply when I was under psychiatric services, but the psychosis not really so much. But I always felt, in terms of symptoms that were disruptive to the way that I lived my life, psychosis was the one that created the most disruption. I saw a psychiatrist who was absolutely amazing on the NHS, and he had gone through all of my notes. We had a really long conversation, and he said to me, you know, you have schizotypal personality disorder, which came as quite a surprise because it was never really something that was on my radar at all. It does cover the psychotic symptoms. For me, it's more delusions. Like, I have very odd ideas about things at times. And schizotypal is, you know, one of the diagnostic criteria is that you do have delusions or disturbed patterns of thinking. Also, a lot of it comes from paranoia and social anxiety, which is something that I do struggle with quite a lot. I know sometimes doing these kind of videos, it doesn't always seem like I'm someone who does struggle socially. But that actually is the case outside of work. You know, I'm quite reclusive. I don't really tend to socialize a great deal. I do struggle with social anxiety and in groups of people. So all of the energy that I do have in terms of socializing and mixing with people, that tends to go into my work life. So in a lot of ways, the diagnosis did make sense, but because it's not really on anyone's radar and it's one of the rarest personality disorders and no one really talks about it, it did come as quite a shock, because for me, BPD felt like it fit exactly what I was experiencing. And to a certain degree, I think it still does. I do still have BPD traits. It's just that I don't meet enough of the criteria anymore to qualify for a full diagnosis. And the symptoms don't affect my life to such an extreme way as what they used to.
Mm-hmm. It is very interesting, and so often you see this, right, with groups of diagnoses. So both of these falling under being personality disorders, there is often this crossover. And yet, you know, you're very right that there can be these gaps when certain conditions are lesser known, are lesser trained for medical professionals, are lesser talked about, then they do get overlooked. And I think that sounds like some of the, you know, the lived out experience of that you were seeing when elements of psychosis symptoms you were experiencing were kind of lesser looked at because they contradicted the BPD diagnosis. Yeah. And so it was like, okay, this is your diagnosis. This is the core thing you're in this person's office to talk about. And so that stuff is treated as more transient, which indeed often psychosis, when it's a separate thing or a part of another condition, is temporary. But it sounds like you'd had enough experience of it not being that temporary and not being, certainly not being one-off by any means, that I'm glad you found somebody that was able to kind of look at the long-term patterns and kind of get even more accurate for you.
I think that's the thing. And when you look at mental health disorders, especially personality disorders, there is such an overlap in symptoms, especially amongst clusters, that, you know, it is quite likely that you will get at some point a misdiagnosis, just based on the fact that, as you said, that there isn't an awful lot of expertise, or the expertise is very specialized. So not every professional that you meet is going to have a tremendous awareness of all of these disorders. So for me, I definitely don't blame anybody for the fact that it wasn't picked up until quite late, because it is a really difficult job when you've got these disorders that overlap so much. But having said that, I do think that, you know, the fact that there are disorders out there that nobody talks about makes it much harder, because that is when you are likely to type things into Google and see, for example, Reddit. And then you will see quite a few things on there that are maybe not accurate or slightly biased in terms of people's experiences of people with personality disorders. When I was first diagnosed with BPD, I was told, do not go away and Google BPD, because you are going to see a lot of things that aren't so nice. And I actually think over time, the stigma around BPD in particular has decreased, but it is still there for other disorders, definitely other personality disorders. So I think we are getting there with BPD, but as a whole, this general lack of awareness and the fact that people aren't talking about it is really contributing to that stigma.
Mm-hmm. And something we talked about off air was how so often when you are trying to get insight, the thing that can be lacking is the personal experiences that people are sharing, that, you know, the less common or the less talked about conditions, there aren't as many people coming forward and sharing their experience. And actually, that's probably when you need it the most, when you're not finding people, you know, day to day in the rest of your life versus a condition like anxiety, where it's much more common, much more talked about, and therefore is easier for people to talk about and be upfront with?
I think that's it, definitely. I mean, if you look at the numbers, the incident rate of personality disorders is quite low anyway. Statistically, you are not really likely to bump into several people a day with a personality disorder. So you do naturally turn to the internet for your sources of information. And when I was diagnosed with BPD, I found that there was quite a lot out there in terms of information, probably less so with schizotypal. But what I was really struggling to find was stories that people had shared about how they live with it and how they cope with BPD. Schizotypal, I'm still searching. There's actually not much out there at all in terms of how people live with schizotypal personality disorder. But I think because of the fact that they are quite rare and not talked about, we do naturally turn to the internet for that information.
Yeah. And it is such an asset that we have that, but then it's also part of a broader problem of the onus being so often put on the people experiencing it to understand, you know, their experience. At the same time, you have something going on for your brain which is affecting your perception of reality. And so it's a real uphill battle to be like, okay, how do I understand my experience when I don't have the context of other people's?
Exactly. And I think sometimes that's a really difficult thing, because if you look at personality disorders in general, if you look at BPD, for example, you only need 5 of the 9 criteria. And that isn't taking into account things like comorbidities, people's personality, the environment, their culture. Everyone is going to be so different that there is no universal experience of a personality disorder. But you will find that certain symptoms will be common in people with BPD. And I think that's what I was really struggling with. Like, I was reading about how people would have this explosive anger in BPD, and I was thinking, well, actually, I don't really feel like that fits me. Yes, I feel angry, but I'm not having rages, you know, I'm not smashing things, I'm not being abusive or shouting and swearing at people, because it's all inside. And I think this lack of diversity around experiences makes it quite hard sometimes, if you think that there is something wrong, to actually pinpoint what it is that you're experiencing. Because I think if it hadn't been picked up by a professional who was looking at schizoaffective disorder or bipolar disorder for my initial diagnosis, I wouldn't have read a list of symptoms of BPD and thought, actually, that's me. Because even things like the self-harm, when you think about self-harm, the behaviours that I indulged in that were quite damaging, I would never have classified as self-harm. And it was only when I was talking to the psychiatrist and they were like, those are self-harming behaviours, that I realised that what I was doing was self-harm. So I think if you have different experiences, that's going to open people's eyes a lot more to what could potentially be wrong. And I know that I mentioned self-diagnosis before, it's not always positive, but if it's educated, then actually you have got some evidence to take to a professional and pursue a diagnosis if that is what you want.
Yeah, no, that's definitely the kind of self-diagnosis I'm into, because ultimately the way our medical systems so commonly work, you need the formal diagnosis to get the right support. And so if you can, show up with pre-research, I mean, that's what I did. The first diagnosis I ever had of depression, I'd researched the shit out of it, and to the point where I no longer trusted myself. I needed a medical professional to be like, have I convinced myself this is what I have? And, you know, to them, it was very clear that was what I had. So that was very helpful. Also, I want to highlight there what you mentioned about self-harm, because that's something that is very relatable for me. I didn't realise that what I was engaging in when I was younger was self-harm, because it didn't fit the stereotypical idea of self-harm we can be given. And it's something that I feel quite conflicted on, because on one side, I understand that a lot of the time what is portrayed is narrow because media organisations have enough, hopefully, awareness to be like, okay, we don't want to give people ideas. You know, and we've had times on the podcast where guests have shared types of self-harm that would have never occurred to me. And there is that worry of, okay, what if people hear this and it gives them ideas? You know, what if that's something that we internalise? And yet there must be some kind of solution of how people still know what they're going through as self-harm. And I think it is having a broader conversation about it, you know, not necessarily talking about, okay, these are all the things that can be included, but this is the kind of psychology around what is self-harm. You know, it's a behavior that is creating some kind of like faux emotional release where it can distract from the emotional pain via physical pain, and it doesn't have a, to speak medically, a quote unquote positive reasoning. So like a fully logical kind of explanation at times to other people. Other people can't always relate to it. So hopefully, you know, that is something that's also continuing to improve. These broad conversations of self-harm is much more than we think it is. I've also had the same with suicidality. I didn't realise that if you don't have a plan, you can still be experiencing suicidal ideation. That all the times I considered very regularly what it would be like if I wasn't around anymore, or fixating on the idea of my funeral or how friends and family would react, was a version of that. It just wasn't the stereotype that I was used to.
Exactly. And I think that's one of the things that maybe the media needs to think about in terms of the way that they present mental health, because it is so diverse. There's quite a lot of people who have had mental health diagnoses who maybe don't relate to what they're seeing in the media, and then have been really quite shocked by their diagnosis. You know, there are people on the team that I work with who have got other cluster B disorders apart from BPD. I'm sure they won't mind me saying there is a member of the team who is completely anonymous and will not put their face to the project for fear of stigma, who has narcissistic personality disorder. And I think when they got that diagnosis, we were all genuinely quite shocked, because when people think about NPD, they're thinking about those interpersonally exploitative behaviours. And again, with NPD, you only need 5 of the 9 to qualify for a diagnosis, and this person does not have that symptom. So again, it's about how you present. And I think there's definitely a sense of shame and just absolutely not wanting to have anything to do with this disorder that was apparent in this person. And it's still quite a difficult conversation for them to have, because they feel so ashamed of having this diagnosis. And when you've got a stigma like that around a disorder, it really puts people off getting help. And that's really sad. Like, we do need to talk about mental health, even if it's not a nice conversation or a pleasant conversation. You know, there definitely seems to be 2 sides to mental health. The side that is presentable, that you see in the media, where people are happy to talk about it and tell people, you know, speak up about your mental health. But then there's the other side, almost like the dark side of mental health, where you have got personality disorders, where people don't want to hear it because it doesn't sound very nice.
You're so right. And, you know, again, I think this can be exacerbated by, you know, the idea of pop psychology, or the sort of focus on wellness versus the deeper conversations like we're having, where there's a massive difference between narcissism as a trait that is kind of commonly like talked about on social media versus an NPD diagnosis, and all the kind of the nuance and the layers that go along with that. And, you know, what you're describing here is very much the mentality behind the organisation that you created. So could you share a little bit about that?
Yeah, so myself and a friend who also has a personality disorder, we founded Sorry My Mental Illness Isn't Sexy Enough For You around about this time last year, actually. We've been discussing it for quite some time, saying, you know, about this dark side of mental health and the fact that nobody really talks about it and nobody is hearing the other side. Like, you know, it's quite common to open a newspaper or go on a website and see like sociopath or narcissist sort of like all over the headlines, kind of like as clickbait. But actually, we know quite a lot of people just from our past experiences with mental health, where we've been in places or situations with people with these kind of diagnoses, that actually it's not sensationalist. Like, for a lot of people with these diagnoses, you wouldn't even know that they were there. Where actually a lot of these people are either in recovery or they are not to that extreme. So what we wanted to do was share those stories, which is why we set up the website. And initially it was quite difficult. We took a lot of stories from people that we knew, but we struggled to really get stories about NPD, ASPD, schizoid, schizotypal, either because of stigma and people didn't trust us to tell their stories in a way that was sensitive, or just because they were so unknown that we couldn't reach people to tell those stories. So we actually spread the word via social media. And over time, it's really grown, and we've got an awful lot of stories coming from everyone in terms of schizophrenia, schizoaffective, CPTSD, psychothymia, all of those kind of things, as well as personality disorders. So we have been sharing those stories anonymously for just over a year now. The website is currently down at the moment because we are redesigning it, but it will be going back up sort of in the next week or so. So hopefully by the time this comes out, it will be back up and running. But the idea is really to tackle the stigma and misconceptions around these. And we also wanted it to be a source of support, not only for the people who have these disorders, but also for friends and family that, you know, have maybe found out that their loved one has got a certain condition and they don't know anything about it. They don't know how these people live their lives. So we wanted it really to share these stories, but also to show the positives as well as the negatives. And I think if you look at some of the stories on the site, it's not like we're saying everything is, you know, rainbows and unicorns. It's not. And the people that submit these stories are usually in recovery, or they are really quite self-aware, which I accept that not a lot of people always are with personality disorders, but it does give you the perspective from the other side as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I really appreciate that. And it's so important, like you mentioned, you can see how this plays out in the common kind of media stories we see, where often it is, you know, celebrities talking about most commonly discussed mental health conditions. And, you know, I know firsthand about those conversations behind the scenes that go on of, okay, maybe, you know, lead with talking about this diagnosis of yours versus this one. That will play out better. You know, that PR people are having those conversations. It just keeps things as they are. And then when you do see experiences of conditions like you're mentioning, it more often is like the clickbait. It's like the extreme effects of a particular condition. Or it's somebody that isn't, you know, as well known, and their story can be kind of twisted because it's not seen as unintentionally or unawarely or not. It's not seen as valuable, you know, and that can include journalists that have stigmatizing ideas. You know, it can be that, okay, this, we need to spin this story in order to get people to click on it. It's a whole thing. So I love the work that you do. It's great to hear that people are finding so much from it. And, you know, what has been the response like in terms of being so public, sharing your experiences?
Well, initially, when we first started out, I was adamant that I was never going to show my face, not only for the teaching perspective, but also because I didn't want to sort of invite any kind of negativity. And I always knew that that negativity would at some point come. The most notable time, I think, was probably earlier this year when it was the Johnny Depp and Amber Heard trial. I actually have no real opinion on the court case itself. I didn't really follow it. But when Amber Heard was diagnosed, or it was suspected that she had a diagnosis of BPD and histrionic personality disorder, you did find that things kind of exploded then with the negativity around BPD and the idea that every person with BPD is an abuser, which is just not true. Yes, there may well be people with BPD that are abusers, but it's certainly not all of us. There was a lot of negativity that was directed towards us at that particular point in time. And, you know, whenever we share a story from the perspective of somebody with narcissistic personality disorder, it always bubbles up again. Recently, we were featured in The Guardian, which was amazing. Like, we had so many people contacting us saying, what you're doing is so helpful to us. We find it so useful. But then at the same time, we also had a fair bit of negativity from people who didn't really understand what it was that we were doing, or thought that because we feature stories from people with certain disorders that we supported abuse, which is just not the case at all. Obviously, we would never condone abuse, whether it's committed by someone with a personality disorder or not. But we had an awful lot of negativity. And it was quite difficult for me personally to get correspondence from people saying you should not be a teacher because you have a personality disorder. And there were quite a lot of things that were directed at us that were really unkind and just really unpleasant. Like, I find it quite difficult to understand because for me personally, if I see something that I don't like or don't agree with, I just kind of scroll on and scroll past it. So for me, it's quite odd that somebody would actually take the time out of their day to send me what is essentially abuse. And I always find it really ironic when people would say, you've got BPD, you're an abuser, you're a terrible role model, and like just really nasty things. And I'm thinking, if you're accusing me of abuse, but you are sending me verbal abuse, like it doesn't, like it's not right. And yeah, that can be difficult. It is a minority, but it is very difficult to handle when that happens.
Yeah, no, I'm sorry to hear that. It's fucked up. And, you know, I try and remind myself, because I get a certain amount of that myself, when, and it is generally that people completely misunderstand what the podcast is. Like, I can tell straight away if somebody's never listened to it. I also kind of try and remind myself that it is a position of privilege, that if the thing that someone perceives as ruining their day or worth hurling abuse at somebody over is something that doesn't relate to them, is something that's, you know, happening on the internet, not actually in their own life, that is a position of privilege. And I think that's a reason why, whatever your mental health condition is, for example, there can be a certain solidarity of like, I may not understand somebody else's experience of a condition that I don't have as well as one that I do, but I'm also going to understand, I'm going to make assumptions of it's also difficult. There's clearly challenges there in the same way people would perceive that about me. And so, yeah. Also, I read the Guardian article and it was a lovely read and it was very positive. people are really
so nice
going out. Yeah, they're really going out of their way to be like, you are a demon. But there it is. That's why we do what we do. So for now, we will wrap up. If people want to find your work, go read the stories for themselves, follow the Instagram, where can they go?
So our Instagram is at Lives Not Labels. The website is currently moving domain. So it will be livesnotlabels.com. It is currently .co.uk, but it will be .com. If you're in any doubt, just go on the Instagram because we'll link to it.
Great. Thank you so much. We will wrap up there.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening. For a list of our recommended resources, visit mentalpodcast.co.uk. And remember, we are in no way a substitute for qualified counselling or other mental health support. Our show is edited and produced by the brilliant Pete Murta, with licensed music by NetSky. Links in the description. Speak to you next Thursday, and remember, you are enough.